From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Dan Raviv, national correspondent for Israeli-based channel I-24 News, and Michael Warren. He's White House correspondent for The Weekly Standard. I'm your moderator, Paul Brandis, Washington bureau chief for West Wing Reports. And here are the issues. The summit between President Trump and the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is off. What happens now? Trade war, no trade war. China and the U.S. continue to talk about imports, exports, tariffs, and deficits, and new developments in the investigation by Special Counsel Robert Mueller as his probe of links between Russia and the Trump campaign rolls into year two. Well, gentlemen, let's start with this U.S.-North Korea summit President Trump has pulled out. He sent a letter to Kim Jong-un, the North Korean leader, said he blames Pyongyang for what he calls, quote, hateful rhetoric on the North Koreans' part. North Korea, for its part, has responded by expressing surprise and says it's, quote, deeply regretful that the summit is off. Michael Warren, let's start with you. In your view, was that the real reason that Trump was unhappy about this?
Well, it seems to be, and this is what sources of mine at the White House tell me, is that this was the sort of straw that broke the camel's back, the final nail in the coffin for this summit. The administration had been very, very frustrated with the North Koreans basically for the last 2 weeks. We learned that efforts by the Americans to go to Singapore to do some pre-planning for this summit, they were essentially stood up by the North Koreans, according to the administration. All communication essentially was cut off not long or maybe immediately after Kim met with Xi Jinping, the premier in China, a couple weeks ago in May. And then finally, it was a statement from the North Korean regime that was responding to the vice president's talk about using a Libya model, essentially the idea of trying to get North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons. The North Koreans viewed this as a pretext for trying to get rid of the regime entirely in North Korea, really anger the North Koreans. They released a statement referring to Vice President Pence as a political dummy and also threatened, in the administration's view, a nuclear showdown with the United States. That's, again, the straw that broke the camel's back for the president, who decided late on Wednesday night to pull out of the summit.
Dan, is there any possibility that this is all just perhaps some kind of a bluff on the president's part that is trying to just sort of, you know, get the upper hand here, bring them back to the table somehow? What happens now?
Well, it is possible. We can't be sure. We have two unique leaders. Here we are in Washington, D.C. The president of the United States is Donald Trump. He's unconventional, a different kind of president. In many ways, we've gotten used to him as president, the change in style. But it's been just 16 months. Not everybody has figured him out. And certainly the world scene hasn't figured him out. So is there going to be a summit or not? What was that letter about? Why did Trump cancel? Because he suspected the North Koreans were going to cancel? I mean, thank you, Mike, for listing all the little things that happened. But there's still the big picture. Right? Last year, we seemed on the edge of a crisis. North Korea had tested nuclear weapons, said it had a hydrogen bomb that it tested, and of course was testing missiles that became long-range missiles and could threaten the west coast of the United States. President Trump said Americans will not live under that threat. The result of all that, North Korea suggesting a summit. President Trump saying that China was being useful, and now President Trump instead says China has not been helpful and has been kind of pushing the North Koreans to give the United States a hard time. So the picture is changing really rapidly. As you say, canceled, then North Korea gives a positive kind of remark. We're willing to talk anytime. I mean, it's really possible by the time that people hear this broadcast that the story could change. I don't know that the summit will be turned on again, though President Trump said maybe June 12th in Singapore after all. Wow. And that's why it's all a mystery, but it's really important. That was a dangerous crisis we were at half a year ago.
And you make a good point by bringing that up. I mean, people do forget that it was only, as you say, what, last September, October or so, when Trump was this incendiary rhetoric, calling him Rocket Man, and each side threatening to destroy the other. That underlying problem has not gone away.
As you say, and it's felt in the region. Now, what else have we noticed as Americans, as American reporters, that South Korea, absolutely an age-old ally of the United States, is going its own way. South Korea's President Moon Jae-in really wants peace with North Korea. He wants to eliminate the threat of war. Who can blame him? South Korea is right there, has a lot to lose. And at first, I felt that Trump administration officials didn't fully trust President Moon. Like, he's a pro-peace dreamer. And then for a while, President Trump joined his camp wanting to have the summit with North Korea and that it's going to go great. And President Trump started saying, folks say that maybe I should deserve the Nobel Peace Prize. And so he loved that. But then President Moon of South Korea this week visited here, was at the White House. And I'm sure he had his ideas. He had met with the dictator of North Korea. But something in all that made President Trump think, nah, this guy's wrong. We have to have a tougher line on North Korea. And that's where Trump ended the week.
Well, Michael, doesn't sort of Kim see his nuclear weapons, talking about Libya, to not have actual nuclear weapons? Well, the North Koreans do. Doesn't Kim understand that that's his security blanket? The only reason we're dealing with them in the first place is because they do have these weapons. Why would we expect him to give up the only bargaining chip that he has?
That's a really good question. And I don't think that the White House and the administration have a good answer for this. Early on, when we first heard back in March that North Korea wanted this summit, the administration kept insisting the policy is denuclearization of North Korea. Talking with this week, after the summit was canceled, talking with the administration, they say the policy remains denuclearization. The president was talking about just a month ago how he really believed that Kim was committed to this, and that's why they were moving forward on this summit, that Kim was committed.
And what was the United States offering to North Korea?
Was offering financial support, essentially. It was saying, if you give up these nuclear weapons, there's a way that, very similar actually to the JCPOA, at least on the surface level, the Iranian nuclear deal, we will give you something to essentially make you whole and offer you security so that you and North Korea do not feel threatened and that Kim's regime does not feel threatened.
And you agree it wasn't just the lifting of sanctions as in the Iran case.
That's right.
But President Trump publicly said, we will make you rich.
That's right.
Very simple word.
And
rich.
Great.
Rich and great.
Rich and great.
But, you know, I go back to this question of, did the president ever actually believe that Kim was committed to the idea of denuclearization? Because everything that we know, and again, North Korea, it's a bit opaque. You can't always exactly figure out what Kim is thinking and doing and certainly who he's talking with. But do we really believe that a man who believes his regime and the future of his regime and the security of his regime is based on having a nuclear program? This is a part of the Kim ideology. It was willing to do so. And you go back to the question of, could this summit happen, either this existing summit or a future summit happen in the future? Does the president really believe, and I think this is something the White House and the administration does not have a good answer on. When they were asked this on Thursday, they said that it's very difficult to trust Kim and to trust Kim on any promises that he's committed to denuclearization. And I think that's what is confusing, not only to our allies in the region like South Korea and Japan, but even to people here domestically, is what does the president actually believe he can get out of Kim at this point?
Well, and to flip that around, when people say, well, can Kim be trusted? There are foreigners, including close American allies, who might ask that same question about President Trump. Can right. President Trump be trusted as well? He changes his mind an awful lot on issues. Can he be trusted?
Well, you heard the couple of seconds of silence there. We cover President Trump. I said it's been 16 months. We're not sure. There's not that much evidence. But the United States is the unavoidable partner in any multinational deal. All right, I used to say that, but of course, President Trump decided to pull out of the Paris Climate Change Accord, pulled out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and even threatens to pull out of the North America Free Trade Accord, NAFTA. These could all be bargaining positions where President Trump has said from time to time he's just looking for better deals for the United States. So at his core, according to what he himself has said as a candidate and now as president, he's determined that America wins. He doesn't really believe in everybody winning. He doesn't think that's the way the world works. And so that's the core. And if you're in the world and you want to understand President Trump, just see that. He wants America to win.
Well, on that point, though, that's not really how symmetry works, though. I mean, symmetry is sort of you go into it, in my view, hoping to get kind of a win-win outcome where each side gives something up, gets something back in return. But Trump has this binary view, as you say, it's you're either a winner or a loser. So it's awfully hard to go into some kind of a, you know, summit with a guy who's threatening to blow you up and has the means to do it, apparently, and think that there's going to be kind of a binary outcome.
And the other thing that we're really discussing here is that the president sets his own policies. There are experts in his administration, people who have for decades studied Asia, have an understanding of Korea and other parts of international relations. But President Trump, who's not an intellectual, is not from that kind of political or policy background. He's going with his gut. He's going with his instincts. Now, they got him elected in 2016. And if you ask him, he thinks it can still work, even on the world stage. We don't yet know.
I think as well, the other thing, and this doesn't just apply to North Korea. We can talk about a million different topics, from trade to legislative affairs domestically here. The president has a lot of advisors who don't agree. That's not necessarily a bad thing. The problem is that he ping-pongs in many ways between what those advisors are saying. I think that's what you're hearing on his North Korea policy. You have John Bolton, the National Security Advisor, much more hawkish, much tougher, somebody who's willing to talk about a Libyan model out loud. I think that's what in many ways enraged the North Koreans. And somebody like Mike Pompeo, who has been making efforts for the past several weeks to achieve a more diplomatic end to this crisis. And the president, again, seems to ping-pong between advisors without settling on a coherent way, strategy, and tactical way forward.
And before we move on here, Dan, you mentioned something interesting before. I mean, the president seems to be really good at kind of a breaking things that have been done before. He walked away from the six-nation Iran deal, the Paris Climate Accord, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. He says, I can get better deals. But some of those things were broken on his watch almost a year and a half ago now, and there hasn't been, has there been any progress on any of those things that he's broken? Do we have any new deals on any of these things yet?
Of course, we don't have the results yet, and supporters of Donald Trump would say, give him time. In almost all those areas, there are ongoing talks. On the climate change accord, not so much. But trying to have one-on-one new trade arrangements with major partners in Asia, yes, that's going on. With other parts of America's relationship with countries like South Korea, Japan, Vietnam, there are important talks taking place. Certainly there are efforts to talk with Mexico and Canada about changing NAFTA so that that trade agreement would be better for the United States. So it's not for lack of trying, except for the climate change accord.
All right, we're going to take a break here. More issues in the news in just a moment. Here's a reminder, meantime, that you're listening to Issues in the News on the Voice of America in Washington. If you'd like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on your website at voanews.com. And don't forget to like us on Facebook, Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel, Dan Raviv. He's the national correspondent for Israeli-based I-24 News, and Michael Warren. He's White House correspondent for The Weekly Standard. And I'm your moderator, Paul Brandis, Washington Bureau Chief for West Wing Reports. We were talking before, gentlemen, about North Korea and China and all of that. And, you know, China always looms large over anything to do with Asia. And, you know, it seems to me that you've got the U.S. and China, the world's two biggest economies. From day one, the president has made a big issue out of the fact that Beijing has this big trade surplus with us. It's about $375 billion. Trump has exaggerated that figure, but there's still a big trade surplus, nevertheless. He says we're being ripped off, it's unfair, and he's flirted to varying degrees with a trade war by talking about tariffs on everything from steel and aluminum. Beijing has fired back by importing less pork and soybeans, things like that. So, and now there have been some new developments this week, Michael, with the vehicles and auto parts. Bring us up to speed on all of that.
Yeah, again, part of this ongoing negotiation for which we're never quite clear where the administration is, where it really wants to go. I've noticed in covering trade issues for the past couple of months with regard to the White House that the White House at large, sort of the larger groups of staff who work on these issues, are very much focused on, can we hammer out some kind of deal, whether it's on vehicle imports, vehicle parts, the steel and aluminum tariffs, which were a bit of a surprise surprise to the rest of the White House staff when the president announced those. Is there a way that we can sort of work around the margins on this? And that's one view. I would say it's probably the majority view within the White House. But that runs up against the view of some very powerful aides who were in the president's ear, and really the president's own gut instinct on this, which is to push as hard as possible on China, not just for this trade imbalance, but for a lot of other elements of China's economic regime, the sort of stealing of American trade secrets through sort of cyber warfare, essentially, and the sort of sense that they won't go so far as to say China's manipulating its currency, but that viewpoint is always in the background of advisors like Peter Navarro, Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary. These folks, I think, stoke the president's view on these things that sort of a, as it's been called toward North Korea, maximum pressure, that there needs to be a sort of maximum pressure on China on a lot of these trade elements. And that comes in conflict with a lot of the administration's negotiators, people like Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, who are really trying to work on the margins here and try to figure out, okay, how can we hammer this some kind of deal out where everybody comes away satisfied? And I think what you see in the frustration for those of us observing is that that inability to kind of come together within the administration with a unified view about what to do leaves everybody wondering, well, where does the administration really fall on the specifics of any kind of trade deal?
Now, the question for you, Dan, is we were talking about North Korea a minute ago. You know, President Trump is hammering China on trade, wants to get tough. Yet at the same time, he wants their help on North Korea. How does he finesse two priorities like that? How does that play out?
Well, just a couple of months ago, the Chinese factor sounded like a positive one as President Trump was describing things. He was thanking his friend, as he put it, President Xi Jinping, for helping to put very strong sanctions on North Korea, and that brought North Korea to the bargaining table and opened the way to what could be a terrific summit. But as prospects for the summit dimmed, President Trump started to say, you know, it's China's fault that he felt that President Xi had spoken to the North Korean leader and had told Kim Jong-un, give the United States a hard time. And that must be why North Korea was starting to speak in more hostile terms. And so here was Trump blaming China. And that signaled that the trade talks aren't going well, that China and the U.S. are trying to put pressure on each other using the North Korea issue in the middle and other things. I mean, this past week, China did make it easier for American companies to sell their cars inside China. That was a concession by China. They're probably waiting for the United States to make some concession. But there's the question that Mike raised, whether we're talking about small steps and things might improve a little bit, and the trade imbalance, $375 billion a year, meaning that China sells to the U.S. a lot more than the U.S. manages to sell to China, that number, $375 billion, could be reduced. And President Trump could say, that's a win. That's good for American industry and American workers. On the other hand, if he's going to push really hard for a major change, and especially if there's a trade war, then prices will go up. U.S. consumers love having cheaply made goods from Asia, especially from China. If prices go up, American consumers will suffer, and we'll even have more price inflation in this country. It's a danger. Many in the Trump administration know it's a danger, but they think this is the time to fight the fight because nobody was pushing back against China's exports and its policies.
And the fact that you mentioned, Michael, something very interesting, kind of glossed over it, but it's a big deal, this cyber theft of American intellectual property. The former head of the National Security Agency, General Keith Alexander, wrote about that and said it amounts to something like $600 billion a year. He's called it the biggest economic espionage theft in human history. We're talking about this $375 billion trade deficit, but theft far more than that. What can be done about that quickly?
Well, this is a difficult problem that I actually think the Trump administration has done a very good job of identifying. Back in March, the United States Trade Representative released a report that documented not just that, but forced technology transfer. The idea that if you're an American company doing business in China, the Chinese government essentially can take what you have, what's proprietary, and take it from you and take ownership of it. The problem is is the solution. And I don't think that there's been any good solutions conceived by the administration. And I think this comes from a problem, which is exactly what you were sort of talking about there, Dan, about the way that the Trump administration and the president himself sort of thinks tactically and less so strategically, because this is bigger than simply economics. This is a major power that is influencing everything from the North Korea talks to our economic power to threats to other allies in the region and other countries in the region. You look at some of the confrontations in the South China Sea. These are things that I think the administration and the president needs to be thinking about more strategically. And that's why he's unable, I think, to come up with a lot of solutions.
All right. We're going to continue that probably at some point in the future, but we're going to move on here. As we mentioned, this investigation by the special counsel Robert Mueller and any possible coordination between President Trump and his campaign in Russia, it's now in year two. Now, Trump continues to try and discredit Mueller, saying it's a witch hunt. There's nothing to see here. What's going on now as we head into year two? Mueller actually has issued a series of indictments against a whole bunch of people, some of whom did work for the campaign, some of whom were, in fact, Russians. Kind of a where are we as we head into year two here?
Well, I think for the American public, there are a lot of questions, and the president has actually done a very good job of discrediting Mueller, of sort of hitting rhetorically the idea that it is a witch hunt. There was a poll recently done, and the phrase most associated, I guess the highest association, was the term witch hunt. But as you point out, Mueller has actually gotten several indictments. He seems to be closing in on a couple of areas, whether it's these questions of sort of surrounding Paul Manafort, the former campaign chairman, whose business dealings in the Ukraine on behalf of sort of pro-Vladimir Putin political interests in the Ukraine, how that may have affected and had something to do with the efforts by the Russians to interfere in the 2016 election. And more specifically to President Trump, there are and there do remain questions, and it's very clear that Mueller is pursuing an effort to figure out if Trump himself has tried to obstruct justice or at the very least try to interfere with the investigation as it's going on right now.
But we have to include that President Trump has raised an issue that many Americans are embracing, which is that his campaign was wrongly spied upon, which would mean, President Trump says, that the Obama administration sent agents to examine what the Trump campaign was doing. And he says totally wrongly, had nothing to do with Russian collusion. And now key members of Congress have had a briefing as to what, in fact, the FBI and other parts of the U.S. government were doing. What is it they saw? Was Russia trying to meddle in the U.S. election? It brings us back to the core issue. Whereas President Trump, of course, wants to keep himself and the people closest to him out of trouble, there are some members of Congress who say we need to know the truth, no matter who might suffer.
Now, he calls this Spygate, but critics say he's just playing word games. He's kind of taking it out of a context.
Well,
what's the real truth?
That's
here?
His branding capability. Well, apparently the real truth is that there is an American professor in Britain who sometimes has been an informant for the CIA and apparently on behalf of the FBI during the year 2016, was asked to make contact with some people in the Trump campaign who were suspected of either working for Russia, helping Russia, having had contacts with Russia. And is that spying or not? The FBI actually activated an informant who lives overseas, and he wanted to find out about some specific people in the Trump campaign. So the president's acting very, very offended. It's another way, of course, of distracting from the main investigation by Robert Mueller.
Well, so far, if you look at sort of what Mueller has done, I think 22 different people indicted, more than 100 criminal counts. 16 of those people were Russian individuals, companies associated with online meddling. 5 guilty pleas, 4 people actually worked with or for the Trump campaign. That doesn't sound like a mere witch hunt to me.
No, and also let's remember that some of these targets in this investigation, particularly the former National Security Advisor Mike Flynn and Rick Gates, who was Paul Manafort's deputy and business partner, have turned. They are now witnesses for Mueller and are cooperating with that investigation to get lesser sentences and lesser charges brought against them. So this is not a witch hunt. And I will say that I think the president while he's been very successful, has been wrong to sort of trump up, to use the phrase, the idea that this was spying. I think that that obscures rather than elucidates what exactly was going on, that there really was, as you, I think, laid out, Dan, very well, an American professor living in Britain who was providing information with people in the Trump campaign that the FBI had reason to be concerned about their connections with Russian nationals and perhaps the Russian government.
So your view is it's not necessarily that they're spying on the Trump campaign. They're trying to figure out what the Russians were up to.
Yes. And look, this is exactly what the Americans should expect from the FBI and from the CIA. If there is reason to investigate some kind of involvement by a foreign government in our elections, human assets are the way that the investigators learn information.
All right. We're going to have to end it right there. Our thanks to Michael Warren. He's with the Weekly Standard. And Dan Raviv. He's correspondent for Israeli's I-24 News. This program was produced by the Voice of America Current Affairs, our engineer, Jonah Cummings. And I'm Paul Brandis of West Wing Reports. Thank you very much for listening.
Welcome to